Did you do your sound check?
I did.
Okay. Happy holidays. Did you have a nice holiday? Did you have I mean, Happy New Year is what I meant to say.
Yes, it went well.
Okay. Get this up here first.
Good evening. I trust you had a very good Christmas with the family and friends, and I want to wish all of you a very happy new year. Welcome to our first meeting of 2017. Off to a good start here. So today we have all commissioners, with the exception of Commissioners Morisseau and Wine. All right, I didn't see you there.
Happy New Year again.
So let me say it again. We have all commissioners, with the exception of Commissioner Morisseau, who is away on business and is excused. So moving on to the agenda, do we have a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
Do you have a second?
Second.
All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Motion passes, so we have the agenda approved. Moving on, so next one is the City Council communications. I believe our liaison is unable to present today, so we'll keep moving on. Do we have a community council input? All right, very good. Thank you, Ms.
Thanks
Hummer.
For asking.
Thank you. We'll move on to any other input from the commissioners, from any boards, commissions, anything you want to share across the table? Please.
No substantive update, but that the Wilmington CAC has kicked off. We had our first meeting. That's what we do.
Thank you. Anything else? If not, we'll just keep moving on then. So, Mr. Cullen, over to you for the staff reports, please.
Okay, thank you, Chairman Douglas. The only thing I want to report out on is that we had our quarterly check-in. Planning Commission officers, the City Council liaison, being the mayor, and staff. And we went over a review of the past, actually 6 months, because we didn't have a quarterly check-in in September. So there was 6 months that we talked about. And just for your own information, to show just how hard you have been working, in that six-month period, from the beginning of July till the end of December, you had 14 study sessions, you had 9 meetings, 14 study sessions, 2 briefings, 2 public hearings, and 1 retreat. And so you have accomplished a lot. And we talked about the upcoming quarter. And the big ticket item coming up on the calendar, of course, is downtown livability. And there was discussion from the mayor and the staff about the sense of timeliness to get it through to City Council, because City Council is got an expectation of getting it sometime this quarter so that they can do their review and perhaps take action on it before the end of the second quarter. So the tone was very good, and everyone, we talked a little bit about the retreat and post-retreat, and I'll get into a little bit more detail on that because we have an agenda item about that later on. That concludes my report.
Is this the time that you will talk about the land use table for the OLB2 and the NMU at Eastgate?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Vice Chair Walter had asked me at the last meeting on December the 7th with respect to transient lodging, Eastgate. That's the topic, and with respect to the use, transient lodging, and if you recall, there was some concern because there was a question mark as to whether or not it was a permitted, conditional, or administrative conditional use and the three zoning districts that had been proposed as part of the new Eastgate zoning code, land use code amendments. And when we went back, it was very clear on February the 24th, under the discussion of OLV 2, that it was intended to be a conditional use in OLV 2. And then on April, I want to say 27th, it was, when we were talking about the TOD, it was brought up again, and it was made clear that it was intended to be part of the TOD. And the question that Commissioner Walter had on December 7th is whether or not it was intended to be a conditional use in neighborhood mixed use in MU.
If you could explain and clarify the distinctions.
The permitted use would be outright permitted. Conditional use would require a hearing in front of the public, with the public. Administrative conditional use would be approved by administratively by staff. So back to the neighborhood mixed use, and we went backwards and forwards and we looked at all the minutes and listened to the tapes and all of that. Nothing references neighborhood mixed use and your intent with respect to it. And when it went through, when you had that discussion, which I think might have been in early or earlier in January, it was, I think, put down as a permitted use. So right now, as it went to council, it is shown as a permitted use. And it has been corrected to conditional use for your intent for OLB 2 and TOD. So that's the report.
So NMU, it's switching to conditional use?
No. I'm saying is that we couldn't find anything in the minutes that expressed that your intent was that it would be for all of them.
Right, but it's a new land use law. Mm-hmm. And as such, I would think no discussion instead of it having the assumption with a new line that it's permitted with no discussion, I would think a new line would be either blank or a conditional use, not saying adding the new line to three areas where two of which we say are conditional use, and then assuming the third area would be permitted, wouldn't have been my intention. I would say they would have been the same in all three areas of Eastgate, that it would be conditional. But if we didn't discuss it, I would think it would just be blank, i.e. non-permitted.
The way that it went through, it shows it as permitted.
And I'm questioning that.
Yes, and I can't find anything that backs it up in the record to say that it was your intent that it be that way for all zoning districts, because that's the way it was originally brought forth, was permitted in all of the zoning districts. And then after discussion, it was incorrectly reflected as administrative conditional use instead of conditional mixed use in OLB 2 and TOD. But there's no reference to NMU. That's what we can't find. There's no discussion about it at all. And it was presented and brought forward and when it was initially drafted as a permitted use.
Do you have that table that shows where we saw it as such?
I can get that, yes. Eastgate is probably not going to be coming to City Council till about March at the earliest.
Okay. Because on my part, that would have been an oversight. I don't recall seeing it as a permitted use anywhere. So I would like that confirmed.
Okay, I'll actually get the copy of it and I'll send it along to you so that you can see, and I'll talk to you before the next meeting so that.
Great. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Handlerson, then.
I do have an initial intent, but just to follow up, it would be good to see that because I do recall one table and the table came back to us, and if we said specifically for that table, that's one thing, but if we didn't specify it, then I think we should open it for maybe potential discussion or just kind of see, because if everything was given to us as across the board initially, I kind of agree. I think that discussion or that agreement would have gone across the board too. So I hear what you're saying, that maybe we didn't specify an MU, but it's a little fuzzy. So I think before we go to council, it might be good to clear, so we don't have to go back after it goes to council, and we go with one message that we've already cleaned it up at this table.
Okay.
Happens to me. The second thing, I just had a quick question about downtown livability. There was the South Main CAC that has been conducted over the last year that my understanding was complete. Mm-hmm. Through last year, I had asked a few times if that CAC would be provided to us so that we would have a holistic view for downtown livability before we kind of signed off and sent that to council. So my question is, when will that CAC result be presented to us? Will it be prior to us making our final recommendation to council as a downtown livability package?
Okay. I will defer to the staff working on the downtown livability as to where they might think that would be appropriate to put in the schedule of review or discussions. And that is just, and also for your information, that there's going to be a plan amendment process this year for the East Main Station area to start the implementation for that CAC report. And then later this year, upon conclusion of that plan amendment, if it's a successful outcome, then there will be code amendments that will follow into 18. So you'll be getting, there'll be exposure, more detailed discussion around that area itself. But how it relates to the overall downtown itself as part of downtown livability, I'll refer to staff. And perhaps they can answer that when we get to that agenda.
Okay, all right, yeah, thank you.
Mr. Process, very quickly, again, a clarification. When they hold that public hearing for a conditional use permit, is that a public hearing before the council or before the commission?
I believe it's
a hearing examiner. Okay, very good, thank you.
If I could, just following on to the comments that Vice Chair Walter made, there was a request last time, I think, Mr. Cullen, to follow up in terms of public, to make sure the public is aware in terms of the clarifications that we've gone through.
Yes.
I was wondering if you had an update on that. So.
Yes, we did send the clarification out to all the parties of record for Eastgate. Also updated them on some upcoming meetings with the Transportation Commission and some of where it's been in the past quarter and the study session that Council had on September 19th. So yes, it went out with an overall update about Eastgate, about what the Planning Commission had corrected to clarify and restate that these were intended to be conditional.
Thank you. Was there any feedback, any questions? As far as you know,
I didn't get any questions. That went out last week.
Thank you very much. And also, I want to echo, I think, the comments from Commissioner Hillhurst as well, in terms of the table and the simplicity. I would be quite surprised if we had gone out of the way to distinguish. And so perhaps it is worth revisiting to clarify before we go to the council. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Any other comments, commissioners? All right, moving on then. So we go to the public comment section. We have first up, Ms. Betsy Hummer.
Southeast 26th Street, Sunset Ranch, home of the Bellevue College, student housing, they're not dorms. And I am here as a private citizen just to let you know that the East Bellevue Community Council exists. So I gave you a little map of our jurisdiction there. And then on that side, I put together what's available on our website and some communication information, because I think a lot of people are just unaware that we're out there and that we're elected officials and that we have our constituents that we are responsible for. And then I made a list of the past 3 years, comments that we've heard from our constituents and concerns. I listed them here. I think I've talked to you guys about them before. We have adult family homes. We seem to have quite a few. It's quite a cottage industry out in our neighborhood. And what we would like to see is transparency in zoning. Affordable housing. Lake Hills, East Bellevue, Lake Hills is doing our part with affordable housing since we have a vast majority of the King County Housing Authority and Section 8 coupon receiving. Even the regular apartments take the Section 8. So we'd like to spread that, make sure that it does get spread out through the city. And every time I see downtown livability, I think of fee in lieu of. So if we can just eliminate that, make sure affordable housing is throughout the city of Bellevue. Single family rentals, glad we're going to hear about that. Develop registration and business license. And that applies to the adult family homes because they are businesses in our neighborhoods, which is, they're fine, but we just want to make sure that it's clear what they are, right? And then parks, it all comes down to zoning. Call it what it is and zone it for what its use is. You know, it's not a commercial use, it's a park use. And so I am championing the, I really, Lake Hills Greenbelt is the core of East Bellevue and the core of Bellevue as a city and a park. And nobody wants to see it become a train station or a park and ride or a utility corridor. And capital improvement projects, you guys don't, well, everybody kind of ties into the development of thoroughfares. So 156 and 164th, a lot of people on either side of those streets can't get in and out of their neighborhoods because of the cut-through traffic. And we are hoping that those will be developed as thoroughfares, perhaps urban boulevards, just so that the traffic moves. It's a more appealing commute. It's going to be always be a commute because of the increased density in both employment and housing out there. We just want it to be better than it is and make it a real a focus. And Bellevue College, they've asked, they're building their dorms, big hole in the ground. They've asked for a street vacation. They want $800,000 of City of Bellevue property for free, and we don't. I personally don't think that's a great idea. And they're promising a bike lane, a little bike path sometime down the road for an $800,000 parcel of land. I would like to maintain good communication with Bellevue College, with all of the commissions, make everybody aware that they are in our midst and they are a great factor in our midst, but we also want to keep in mind that the Bellevue residents are what Bellevue's all about, right? And so keep them in mind. And then, I also made a list of what I've noticed about the people who come to our meetings and the people who talk to me and express their concerns. And we're kind, middle-class citizen who vote for what do you guys call them? I wrote it down here. Levies, so that we have better fire and better transportation and better parks. And we need to keep in mind as public servants that they are our constituents and they are why we're here. So we need to always keep that in mind regardless of how much we get into the nuts and bolts and the details. They're the ones who elected us, who hired us, who appointed us, and they're the ones that we're responsible for. And then on my back page, since my neighborhood is right next to Bellevue College, the homeless shelter is proposed to go down in Eastgate, which is right next to me. I went to several of those meetings and wrote up some questions that came to my mind. It seems to have been done in secret. Citizens Advisory Committee is only being formed now, not at the beginning of the process. And it seems to, again, be concentrating where we have affordable housing, already tons of it in East Bellevue, and eliminating the consideration of other sub-areas for that project, right? So I just wrote down a couple of questions, and thanks for letting me talk. Oh, and I appreciate your public service. Thank you very much.
Yes, no. Next up, we have Mr. David Slight. Yep. All right. So anybody else? Yes, sir, please.
Hello. Hello, my name is Carl Vanderhoof. My address is 9 103rd Avenue Northeast. I want to start off by saying Happy New Year to y'all.
Thank you.
Here's to an exciting 2017. And hopefully this livability process may conclude by December 31st, 2017. I think it should take that much time to do this right and see it all the way through council approval. So thanks for your efforts on that. Lots of meetings occurring over the last 2 weeks about this through the BDA that I've attended with staff as well. Staff will tell you tonight that your focus should be on process-related items so that they can get to a public hearing a little bit faster and on time. However, I encourage you to require that the missing TBDs and in the FAR chart and the amenity incentive values, as well as the missing graphics and illustrations, be filled in for your review for adequacy and appropriateness prior to going to a public hearing. It isn't until you have this information, as well as the results of the BERC economic analysis, that you will have the necessary material to make that will enable you to make an informed decision in the best interest of the public. Staff would recommend shortly that the early wins are concluded and do not require your further review. As Commissioner Morisseau pointed out in the last meeting on the topic, that this is not the case. You should look at everything again to see how all the pieces fit together. For instance, one specific item that caught my attention was in section 20.25A 160, section D, regarding through block connections, of which a map can be found on page 84 of your packets. On page 84, you'll see also corresponding with my comments on page 186 of your packet in an email that I sent to the city. I encourage you to ask staff tonight to make a change to the map on page 84 based on commission direction in order to achieve the goals of the comp plan. Specifically, please ask staff to remove the through block connection that's outlined on a portion of Northeast First Place in Old Bellevue. This is in the lower left corner of the map. And hopefully staff can remove this prior to the public hearing. It'll save some work down the road. The intent of the through block connection throughout downtown is to provide an opportunity for increased pedestrian movement through the super blocks. However, this block in Old Bellevue doesn't really qualify as a super block. Furthermore, as you'll see on the map, the connection does not go all the way through the block. So they've got an area that's designated, they want to designate as a through block connection, but it only goes halfway through the block. This will lead to a dead end for pedestrians, and the only location suitable for the back of the house function is in this area. So for this site, this is where deliveries would occur. This is where the garbage would be picked up. This is where the garage entrance is most likely to be located. Every site needs that area. Otherwise, if this is a through block connection, those types of activities will end up occurring on Main Street. So you can see Main Street for pedestrian activity or the back alley of this site as the through block connection intended for pedestrians. Now this will still be a connection. It will still be a thoroughfare. Pedestrians can still walk through there. Cars will still be able to get through there. That will need to be maintained. However, designated as a through block connection means something else. This alley portion is already the back of the house for neighboring properties, the new Park 88 apartments that were just completed at the end of last year, as well as the Borcada apartments have this as their loading zone and garbage areas and garage entrances through there. So it makes sense to me to kind of maintain it as such. So if you can ask staff to give them some guidance on that direction. For additional comments and questions on my review of the draft land use code so far, you'll find those on page 166 through 171 of your packets. I will be sending over additional comments on the latter half of the draft code, as well as comments and questions on the BRIC analysis for you guys to review in days to come. Currently, I've submitted these comments to staff, and I'm hearing a hearing that they don't really want to respond to me directly. So I think that to get your guys' eyes on those, you can decide which of these questions you also would like to know the answer to, or they kind of have you wondering what the intent of some of these code guidelines are. So thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can you give a slideshow?
I've seen those before, but it's short.
Yeah, please sit down.
So while Terry's doing that, we'll get started. I'm Jack McCullough, 701 Fifth Avenue. 6600. Thank you, Terry. Seattle 98104. And I'm joined here by Andy Lockett. Andy, your address?
Fortress Development Group, 508 Avenue Northeast, Bellevue, Washington.
We just wanted to bring in the new year by reminding you of where we were with our, you know, we're going to meet on the 14th, and there the question had come up the last meeting of the year, the week before. Commissioner Hill, of course, had raised it about, you know, what was sort of in the back record on this piece, and we had done a letter, and I thought had sent it in. Oh, you did? Good. Oh, you did? Okay, good. Thank you. Well, I just looked in the packet, and I didn't see it.
It was in our packet.
Before. For that meeting, for the 14th meeting.
Okay, good. We did get it,
good.
Yeah.
Well, just wanted to make sure. So we just done that homework.
Yes.
Wanted to pass that along. So, which one is it here? There it is. Yeah. So this is just an abbreviated packet, but I just wanted to remind you, we showed you last month, and these have been changed slightly. We're getting ready for a pre-op with staff, but these are the updated renderings, and again, part of the pitch here is that we're trying to deliver a very high level of iconic architecture here in this location, tower spacing beyond what is required in the code, open space at ground level beyond what is required in the code, pedestrian amenities beyond what the code is requiring, really amp all of those components up in exchange in the context of a development agreement. If the council decides to approve it, they may not, for the opportunity to have some additional money. And you know our site, and we've gone through this recitation before, but Main and Bellevue, and here's our 2+ acres. The language that we had submitted suggests that the site be at least 2 acres, that it be located in this development block, and it mostly has to be in outside of sub-district B, and if that was the case, then it would be eligible for consideration. Consideration is all. Right. You've seen here how we think the height actually fits in nicely to the wedding cake effect. This is the view from the southwest. And then these are the renderings that have been slightly updated from last time. You can see there's the two residential towers with the hotel at the base. The podium structure is the hotel. Currently anticipated one of the towers may be condominium, one may be apartments. Here's the entry on the south end. Here's the plaza that we're walking through, kind of a merged pedestrian and automobile space, curbless street, kind of a modern day, a modern incarnation of what they call a Gruner. Here we see from above, you can see the significant architecture piece here. This is the entrance off of Bellevue Way on the northeast corner of the site. And that is it. I just wanted to remind you where we were. Look forward to your consideration. Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
Could you remind me, either Andy or Jack, from what to what in terms of height?
Right now, the CAC had recommended 300 feet in MU, and then so far the commission had said they'd like to see that taken down to 250, and then it would be right now in the sub-district B portion, 200. And so what we have asked is that we, not an increase in FAR, no change in anything else, just the ability to go to 300 feet on both sides, in, you know, both of those towers, both in the MU and in the DP portion. The fact that we're not increasing FAR means that these, we're taking what is the amount of development we would have been able to do in bulkier structures that were closer together or more structures, and making them slimmer and taking them up into the sky. So,
is there a ballpark on date of construction?
I'll give that too.
We hope, it depends on the entitlements, but we are hoping to break ground early 2018.
18. How long before?
So, and this would be a 3-year construction schedule. It would be a 2021 building.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your follow-up.
I guess a last call for any other public comment. If not, we'll just keep moving on. So I believe our next topic is our downtown liberal position. So over to you, Mr. Collin. Give us some context, please.
Thank you, Chair Davidos. This next portion of the agenda is a study session on downtown livability. It's reviewing the draft downtown land use code amendments. This has been an ongoing discussion now that has been held over several meetings and is anticipated to be held over several more. We have development services staff, believe Carol Helen. We have planning and community development staff, and Neil King. General order of business, they will discuss what their expectation is or hope is for outcomes, but generally they will present the code language, the proposed code language, and the commission will ask questions and give staff direction as to how to move forward with certain pieces of that.
Very good, thank you. If I could just add one comment before we give it to the team. During our SYNC meeting with our liaison, Mr. Mayor, there was some feedback that obviously it's an expectation around accelerating the closure towards the public hearing. So I just want to share with the commissioners across the table the feedback we have. So with that, we'll give it to you, Ms. Helen. Ms.
Okay. Yep, just loading up one of the PowerPoints.
Emil and I probably want to both note that it is not our intention to go through a laborious PowerPoint process. We did hear you at your retreat. And so the hope is that the information in the PowerPoint that we will make available and post on the website will provide some historical background that can be used by all of you if you want to go back and reference it. We won't go through every detail and every bullet in the PowerPoint. And at the end of the day, when we get to the pieces of the code that we'll be working through, we're going to be testing some approaches that we discussed at your last meeting about how to move through the code in a judicious way.
So tonight we have, Carol and I are part of a multi-departmental team that's really doing the lion's share of the work on drafting of the code and bringing it forward to the Planning Commission as well as interested stakeholders. We're also potentially have Trish Byers, who's the city's co-development manager, joining us tonight as well. The outline that we have tonight is to provide a quick update on the BERC economic study that was completed over the past week and sent out to stakeholders, council, Planning Commission, as well as posted on the internet site. Also give a brief update on the ULI panel that's planned for next week. And then we'll go into a bit of detail on the code as it relates to the CAC recommendations, as it relates to the old code, and talk a bit about the approach for the Planning Commission's review as we move forward over the next few meetings. So first, the economic study and ULI panel, as you remember, based on council direction, we initiated an effort to do an Urban Land Institute panel last November and December. We tried to get it scheduled in December, as well as in the first week and a half or so of January. We ran into a few issues with the ULI Northwest being able to get a critical mass of panelists to volunteer their time to work on it. So our current dates for the panel are January 18th and 25th. As described before, the first day is a briefing for the panelists. It's open to the public and stakeholders so they can see what information is being portrayed to the panelists. It also has a some time slots for interested stakeholders and community residents to be interviewed by the ULI panelists. So I have given RSVPs from interested stakeholders to participate in that. So that's all happening tentatively scheduled for the morning of January 18th. The ULI panel then works and reflects on things over the intervening week, and then they get back together for most of the day on the 25th to finalize their recommendations, and then they actually present to the public and the stakeholders in the city what their findings are. So the afternoon of the 25th is when that would be happening. It's unfortunate that we did get delayed a couple times, but we are trying to follow council direction to pull off one of these panels. It does rely heavily on the kind of scheduling and availability of ULI members, and ULI is the one who actually picks the panelists and gets them all scheduled up. So in some ways, we're doing all we can, but there is the variable with ULI being able to get everybody together in a timely manner. The thought is on the 25th that we hear the ULI panel recommendations in the afternoon, and then we'll be able to actually relay those to the Planning Commission that night, and we'll be able to have Michael Hodgins from Burke Consulting join us as well for that evening. So we'll have a good discussion about what is essentially straight from the ULI panel on the 25th. Clearly, you wouldn't be making any formal drawing conclusions or recommendations of that work at that point, but it would be merely relaying their recommendations to you so you can be beginning to consider them. The economic analysis study, we hit a pretty significant milestone last week where we were able to get that document out to interested stakeholders, community members, commission, and council. So that was emailed out to all of you. It's posted on our city website, and we've also distributed it to the BDA Land Use and Livability Committee that's been patiently awaiting this for a number of months. So we're glad that we're able to get that document out there. There's a couple pieces that we still will be adding to that relating to the some ideas on valuing additional building height. So there's one reserved part towards the end of that document that we will be adding prior to the 18th. Any questions about this process? I know we've talked about this before, but now we have a little bit firmer direction on when this thing's actually going to happen, and you do all have at least the economic analysis that was given you to at least look through during these weeks. Just a very quick reminder on where we are. We feel like we're in the fourth quarter of this effort. We've spent a number of study sessions, as you know, with the commission. We did adopt the package of early wins back in March of last year. We essentially are on your agenda for the two meetings in January. We're on the two meetings in February, and we'll be continuing on with this until we can hold our hearing and spend enough time to have you form a recommendation that you're comfortable with sending along to council. Just a reminder of all the good work that happened with Commissioner Lang and the CAC and the public dialogue that's occurred over the years. This is really grounded heavily in the Citizen Advisory Committee work that happened over those 13 meetings. As well as a great deal of work that happened in these land use code audits to actually sift through our 1981 code and figure out what parts were working and we wanted to retain, what wasn't working and areas where we wanted to look for improvement. So we're constantly reflecting back on the direction from the Citizen Advisory Committee, as well as going back and looking at those code audits to make sure we're suggesting edits to the things that really were given, direction was given to the commission and staff to actually modify. Just a reminder that also in the CAC report, as they had written it up and forwarded it on to the City Council and Planning Commission, each section regarding building height and form, open space, pedestrian corridor, the key thing that they did was, along with the recommendations, they really reflected back to articulate how this exactly related to livability. So we're also looking at this very, very heavily, because we often get questions from stakeholders or council or even other staff about why are we amending this section of the code? How does it relate to livability? So it's good to have these pages in the CAC report that we can always reflect back on to kind of truth up to make sure we are addressing the livability issues at hand. And also something that we talked to you about a little last year, but it's a good reminder, is that the land use code is very important for development, but there are a whole host of other things that really relate to livability. When you talk about people who have jobs, who are living downtown or just visiting downtown. So while we're updating the land use code in our effort, there are things relating to safety and schools and the character of downtown, events, mobility that are not part of this scope but are part of the broader city's livability agenda. So just important to keep that in mind, that we do have our discrete work that we're doing on the code, but this is part of a broader strategy to make our urban center livable for everyone on a number of levels. So before I hand it over to Carol and Trish, I do want to just address the one question about the East Main stationary planning effort. So that work, as you know, was happening at a similar time as the livability work, when you were talking about height and form in and around the OLB and the East Main part of the downtown. So the East Main CAC did finish up their work last summer and fall and actually transmitted their recommendations to council. So I think it would be wise for us to include those in your coming packet, and we can work with Terry to figure out if it would be us giving a brief overview, or if we wanted to bring in the actual project manager that worked on it to kind of give you a summary of what was arrived at for that part of our city, because it does kiss up right against the downtown boundary there, as we acknowledged. So if that's adequate, we can look to have that information in your next packet.
I mean, that's great. It's up to you if it goes in the packet, but thank you.
So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Trish and Carol.
Sure, and I'm going to have Trish go through this part. We wanted to make sure, as Emil had said, that we provided you some framework for the discussion moving forward, where we did take the CAC recommendations that were forwarded to you from the City Council on June 10th of 2015. We looked at each of those categories. We ensured we kind of captured at a high level the CAC recommendations. And then, of course, we wanted to make sure some of those were nuanced, some by the Planning Commission conversations with Emil and Patty Wilma and with Trish, and so that we get the rhythm of how we've moved forward to develop the document that you're reviewing now and will ultimately send to public hearing to get community feedback. So I'm going to have Trish run through these brief slides, and then we will talk about the approach for the rest of the evening and addressing them.
So, good evening. I apologize if it's a little bit late. You guys were moving pretty quickly today. So the column on the left is actually directly out of the final report, as is the column in the middle. And so the first one is public open space, and what you've seen in the proposed code is public open space is addressed several ways, one of which is outdoor plazas. There are several provisions in the new code that talk about open space, and I've just mentioned a few. So the first one is identify and incentivize open space strategies for each district. And one of the things, I talked with Emil this morning, and we were talking about this, and some of the open space things that we have going on, like pedestrian bridges and pedestrian corridor, are already defined by location. The pedestrian bridges can only go in certain places, and the pedestrian corridor is where it is. Some of the other things, for instance, the good example that Emil gave me this morning was, if we want a donation of park property, which is one of the amenities that's proposed, there are a couple of places like East Main and Northwest Village that would be a great place to do that. So we might, when we're talking about the amenity system, we might weight that more heavily. So that's something that we can think about later. That's not in the code now, but that's certainly part of what you can do later.
So for the bridges, the overhead walkways, thank you, pedestrian bridges, you said they're already designated in finite areas?
Yes, they are.
So I guess my question is, if we're kind of revamping all of downtown anyway with this exercise, why can't we expand where those can go during this process to give more flexibility for the new buildings that are coming and just safer access between all those buildings in the future?
So those locations actually have a direct tie to the comprehensive plan because the locations are discreetly identified in the comprehensive plan. And the code does need to be consistent with that. So at this point in time, we're not just looking at the rubric that the recommendations that the CAC gave us, but we have to look for consistency with the comprehensive plan. So at this point in time, pedestrian bridges, one, it was not a piece that was addressed by the CAC, not a piece that was identified for expansion as part of the comprehensive plan update. And at this point in our code development, we have retained the pedestrian bridge provisions that exist in the code as they do today. That might be a separate conversation, but it wouldn't be necessarily one under the rubric of the downtown facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does this amount to a freeze on pedestrian bridges?
Actually, pedestrian bridges, it's not a freeze. Pedestrian bridges were specifically identified in the comprehensive plan, and they were done when we did the some of the original downtown work back in the mid-2000s. Okay. And we identified locations over auto-oriented streets where pedestrian bridges would be appropriate. So those have existed for some period of time. It doesn't roll them back. It doesn't expand them. It just wasn't a topic.
Well, if it doesn't roll them back and doesn't expand them, then I reiterate, does it freeze them?
They do not change.
I can give a clarification on that, if you want.
Because I know that the whole issue of pedestrian walkways was very contentious when it first came up. And eventually the decision was made, and it was a close call, to allow the pedestrian walkway connecting Bellevue Square to Lincoln Square. And it turned out to be a godsend. And so then a second one was added. And it would make sense on an incremental basis to continue allowing them. And I want to just make sure I understand what you're recommending here.
We're recommending staying the course on what's identified in the comprehensive plan because as part of this exercise, we're ensuring consistency with the comprehensive plan. We're not changing. But, Emil, you had something?
I can just correct the work back in 2005 identified three locations on Northeast 8, three locations on Northeast 4, two locations on Bellevue Way. Your current recommendations in the incentive system are to allow those to qualify for amenities. So it's not freezing, reducing, it's just simply I think the summary of the discussion is that people have liked those and the planning commission was wanting to have those as a bonusable amenity.
Thank you for the comment.
Bonusable amenity, but only in those areas.
As Carol stated that.
Which they're going to tap out soon, right? And outside of those areas, those property owners have no flexibility to have a pedestrian walkway over arterials, or right?
That's correct. So as Carol stated, we're guided by the comprehensive plan, which we weren't amending via this particular process. I guess we can flag it as something that when this commission does re-examine the downtown separated plan, it sounds like there's interest in looking at that again.
It just makes sense to me that we're changing, or we're reviewing changes of FAR, or reviewing changes of heights. It just seems like that would make sense if we're updating our entire downtown, that flexibility would hand in hand. And I'm probably, unfortunately, not making the connection of why that's so stoned in the comprehensive plan, but everything else we're doing is a little free game to kind of change around during this process, because I would think that's in the comprehensive plan too. So I'm not connecting why that is in stone and everything else is very fluid and we're allowed to kind of make those changes. So it just seems, if you're going to make it, especially a bonus of amenity, let more people take advantage of that amenity around. And again, safety, right? We're going to just get busier. And we don't necessarily want to take the cars away, but allow opportunities for businesses to, hotels to be walking across, for all the conventions that we have downtown and everything like that. So if there's a way to have that discussion, it just seems like this is the time to do it.
So,
and I don't want to belabor anything. I'm not convincing why we can't talk about
it. Let's just figure out some issues we might want a parking lot, and you might want to recommend to the council as additional items you might want to take under advisement for potentially a later process. And the only reason I'm saying that is because the council actually several years ago stipulated the scope of this review. The CAC identified the areas that they would be, that they've made recommendations. Pedestrian bridges was not part of that. I think you heard in December there was some concern that the whole code was tossed up in the air and redone. In fact, it focused on these three areas that are identified here: public open space, pedestrian corridor, station area planning, design guidelines, and downtown parking, and some other topics. And the council essentially kind of fixed the scope when they sent it here. So I think kind of in that conversation that we've been having about kind of fixing a project scope, moving a project scope forward, to the extent that there's areas where the Planning Commission would be interested in exploring deviation from that scope, it's one that probably requires some communication back with the council, because I think that there is quite a significant interest, as the chair indicated, of getting the materials that we've been working on for some time forward to public hearing. Because the pedestrian bridges are in the comprehensive plan, that also creates another layer of amendment that would need to happen. These are all code amendments that don't require any comprehensive plan amendments. They're seeking consistency with the comprehensive plan. To amend our comprehensive plan, that would take, or the pedestrian bridge locations, that would take additional study. I fully suggest that we keep a list of things that you said during the course of our review, we identified these other things that we think that warrant some updating, and the council can prioritize that for your review. But at this point, you are the ones that we're moving forward.
So if I could jump in. Thank you, Ms. Helen. I think a very good summary you gave us. I would add, though, and I think it was a good question raised by Commissioner Carlson and by Commissioner Hillhorst, around maybe not being dogmatic about being constrained, because I do believe there is enough input and value here for us to say, maybe it's in the parking lot, but certainly a very high priority parking lot, I would say.
Sure.
Thank you.
So for the sake of its expediency, I think I just described on the far left margin, as opposed to maybe going through these one at a time, because we will be going through these in greater detail when we get to the substantive provisions of the code. This will help, as you're tracking through those provisions, identify where they were recommended originally for the scope of the City Council, where the CAC made their recommendation, and kind of the response that was made in the code for your review. So we'll get into that in greater detail, but maybe we should get through some of the materials that we were thinking were important for this evening to move forward. We've also done a similar approach on the dimensional chart guidelines, and that will provide some information for you in moving forward with some specifics and that also aligns with the annotated table of contents that we gave you that describes the differences between the existing code and the future code. And tonight we're not going to talk about any of the most of the substance of the code amendment. Remember, you had asked, are there ways we can get through this so that we know what we should spend our time reviewing versus what we should spend time re-reviewing simply the same code that existed previously? Tonight, our objective is to get you down kind of to the nugget of what you should be really delving into over the course of the next month or so. Does that make sense?
So there are a couple of things that I wanted to tell everyone, and this is it. Go back. No.
The other back.
Okay, so this is not the same annotated table. What I did was I added some more details so that you knew exactly what changed. On the back, there are three charts that compare old code to proposed code. And it will also be on the website for people who are following along, both the PowerPoint from tonight and the charts that we've been talking about, so that you all can take a look at it and mark it up as you choose.
This is this document in your package, right?
And then it has the three charts on the back for your viewing pleasure. So let's move on. The next part is something that we've talked about so that we can sort of peel away the layers as we were talking. And what we've talked about and what Carol has suggested is that what we can look at are the sections that remain unchanged and don't need to be reviewed, and then we can sort of move those aside. Then we can look at the early wins that don't need to be reviewed and push those aside. Then we can look at the process-oriented things and move those aside, and then get to the substantive changes. And that's what we were going to suggest to you all as a way to proceed, so that we can kind of push away some of the things that you've already looked at or just remain unchanged and really don't need any review. If that is okay with you, that's what we'd like to do tonight. Get started on that kind of a review.
Thank you. First, I want to thank you for taking the time, taking your feedback in, and then coming back with the proposal, the approach. And so perhaps quickly go around the table, ask for input in terms of the requests we had made and your thoughts on moving forward.
I just wanted to say thank you for showing the current and the proposed.
Yeah.
That is so helpful. So thank you for that, because and then also you even added in with the 15 feet or 15%, you know, that was a big discussion item for us as well, as if, you know, this plus 15. So thank you for doing that. That's super helpful.
Back to you.
Okay.
We're good. All right. Oops. There we go.
Okay. So what I found as I was going through this is that there are a few unchanged sections just completely unchanged, and then there are a few that just have a few exceptions to the unchanged. So as we go through these unchanged sections, I'm going to mention what's changed, because they're very small in nature, and I thought we could talk about those and then move on. So the first one is the parking standards, which remain unchanged. They were picked up and put into the 2025A. There are just a few changes. One is adding in visitor parking, one stall per 25 residential units in residential buildings. The second one is going from 8 feet from 7.5 feet to 8 feet for parking entries for accessible vans, because they've gotten bigger. Adding in bicycle parking for bicycles, and that's directly from Bell Red. We picked it up from Bell Red and dropped it in. And then offering flexibility, it would be an administrative review to modify required parking ratios based on parking studies. So those are the let's see, 4 things that have changed with the parking standards.
Mr. Chair,
changed from what to what? Visitor parking, one stall per 20 residential units. What's the current
there is nothing as far as visitor parking with residential units. And this was something that we heard. I didn't personally hear, but the people who were working with everyone through the process heard repeatedly from people who were in the public process during the CAC process that that was something that they wanted to see.
How did you come down on 1 per 20 as a ratio?
That's a good question. I don't remember how
you... We actually did this based on some recommendations that we received on recent studies that were conducted by developments for downtown. So that is the kind of the best management practice that we've been observing. Individuals have been, applicants have been including in their applications, and so that we lifted that off there as a suggested point.
And can you tell me about flexibility to modify required parking ratios, how that process works and why that is there?
So that's actually a Bell-Red approach, and I think we...
but it's not limited to Bell-Red.
No,
you're exporting
it's a
Bell-Red
approach, and we're exporting it downtown. When we had the conversation about Bell-Red several years ago, that was one where we had downtown applicants identifying that as a flexibility request, and right now we apply that in a variety of different ways. We apply it in Bell-Red. We also apply it to what's called unspecified uses. So if we don't have a particular parking ratio that has a minimum or a maximum, we require parking ratios to be developed by a consultant based on standard practices, so engineering documents.
Mr. Chairman, fellow colleagues, I'm very suspicious and uncomfortable with this, because we know that some developers would love to get around the expense of creating adequate parking and have that spill over onto others. And here we are creating the mechanism by which they can get around parking requirements. Bellevue's economy is built on parking. Now, Bellevue grew as the retail center of the East Side because of parking. And plentiful, free, or validated parking. And I want to make sure we preserve that standard going forward.
Thank you, Commissioner Carlson. Any other comments on this?
I would just like to echo that the adequacy of parking impacts everyone in the city. And to have that decision fall to one person who may have, you know, in the future, who may have a particular bias or perspective on how it would help the city to not have enough parking, I would think it would behoove the city to have a broader view before making a change of that magnitude. Transportation, parking, these are things you hear all the time. There's not enough parking in downtown Seattle. People don't go there because there isn't parking, or they have to pay too much for it. So we benefit by that in our retail. I would like to see that change have a broader overview before it could change.
Just, I guess, kind of echoing, if we could have maybe a more concrete process, that if that change, that it will come either to Planning Commission or to Transportation Commission, so that it goes through a public process with data as to why the change is being made. So it is such a big thing. So I think transparency, transparent process would be good to do this, so people understand why,
right,
and the data that's backing up the decision versus one person.
Okay, so right now, just so you understand the process, and then I'll suggest a path to move forward. Right now, what happens is if someone suggests parking, we do parking review as part of design review application. Those all receive public notification. We do get feedback. It is a topic that actually applicants and the public alike engage with us on to ensure that the parking expectations are being met for any particular development. That process, once a decision is issued, is appealable to the hearing examiner. So the hearing examiner re-examines that issue and can actually make a ruling that differs from the one that is ultimately made in the staff report when I sign it, or that is suggested by the applicant. So there is a process that includes the public. My suggestion is as I indicated previously, there was a commitment made that we would try this approach in the downtown. Maybe it does not work. If we are finding that it's useful in Bell Red. We found that we apply part of this process already, for instance, to hotels for unspecified uses in downtown. We do parking studies for those. We don't have a minimum and maximum. And we have found that it has been working. My suggestion to you would be, think about leaving this in the draft that's going to public hearing. I've noted your concerns. I can certainly bring back additional information on that if you're interested. You will receive public feedback on that topic, and should you not wish to continue, we can simply take that out of the draft and return it to the status quo approval. That one was one that wasn't a specific piece that came out of the CAC. It was a recommendation that came out of a holdover from Bell Red, and we do know that we will be doing further downtown parking studies in the future after this work is done. So if it's going to become an impediment, I would suggest we move it just to a different place and we retain the status quo right now, but offer up people the opportunity to comment at the public hearings.
Commissioner Brooks, too, please.
Yeah, so what I hear is that we want to experiment with downtown, and what I hear is that right?
We've already been experimenting now with Bell Red. That code has been in right. place since 2009. And we do have a significant amount of experience with it and the decision criteria that go with it.
Right.
We'll learn tonight, too. We'll talk about the process if we have time to get to that. And we are putting more framework around the process so that people understand how deviations from the code get made. So it's sort of an experiment, but understand, too, our code already partially does this for some types of uses in the downtown.
Yeah, so I was going to say, like, even though we're doing it in Bell Red, we're still experimenting in a new area. And so if we want to allow this flexibility, maybe this can take thresholds on it and allow it to happen, but then tie those to some really specific outcomes that we can then evaluate on some periodic basis and include that detail in what you bring back.
So if I could, please go ahead.
Well, my fear, you know, 3, 4, 5 years from now is a city where, because of all these variances, you've got cars driving around and around and around looking for a place to park, all this congestion. So obviously the solution to that as well, too many cars on the road, we need to discourage their use. And let's preempt that from even happening by maintaining the city's reputation for, again, ample, free, and validated parking.
So could we use that as an outcome? That,
sure.
I mean, some sort of impact on traffic in terms of
If I could, so I would say we don't want to cook the goose that lays the golden eggs, and so in that sense, the flexibility does appear to be a concern. So may I recommend that much like we put the bridge in the parking lot, we put this on the parking lot as well, and then perhaps as we make progress, we can decide if it makes sense to put it into the main street or still keep it in the parking lot. Is that reasonable?
Sure. I think more and more people will be walking in Bellevue, and that is a great thing. And more and more people will be bicycling and telecommuting. And all these things are good, but especially with self-driving cars and electric cars, I also believe that cars are not going away anytime soon. And I think it's important that Bellevue, as a visionary city, recognize it.
And in fact, that's a very good point, John. We should be thinking about drone parking ratios as well.
That's a really good idea.
We'll keep this one in the room for now, but we'll put a star next to it, next to it,
that's right.
That maybe even draws, if, to the extent that it does end up moving forward for the public hearing, that we draw some attention to it about the issues that the Planning Commission has raised and request specific focused feedback.
Yeah, a virtual parking lot, if I might. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank
you. Good. Okay, street and circulation.
Okay, so is there any other discussion that we need to have with respect to the parking stand exceptions? Nope. Okay, hearing none, I'm moving on to street and circulation standards. They all are unchanged with the exception of the map that you have on page 52, which has the sidewalk widths. The sidewalk widths are 20 feet, 16 feet, and 12 feet. That's on page 52. I'll wait till you get there. The 20 feet are very limited in nature. There's a little bit in front of Bell Square and then a block away. And then you can see the peg corridor there. And then the rest of them are 16 feet. This is so that we can activate the sidewalks, allow more people to walk along the sidewalks. You know, you can have the street furniture, the street trees, the plantings, all of the things that we're looking for and that the CAC wanted. We can honor those kinds of things as we go through here. There was also an analysis done when looking at this as to what kind of pedestrian traffic was actually there, because some of the smaller streets aren't going to get as much traffic, so you're not going to need the width for that as well. So I think, Emil, do you have any other things to say about how these widths were accomplished, how this map was drawn?
Yeah, this was an example of joint work both by the CAC process as well as the complementary transportation plan update process that was happening. So they had forwarded over a small set of recommended changes. When the Planning Commission was doing its review last year, we actually had some what I'm going to call the delta or change maps that took this map and then annotated it with where it actually was changing from the current code. So that is a piece that you've looked at before. If you'd like, we can also, we'd be putting that in the public hearing draft as well, just so to relate to people where things exactly are changing from current code standards.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, to show the what is it today, what is it tomorrow, because sidewalk widths, it'd be nice if it citywide had changed, only in the OLB, only in the downtown.
Yep.
It would be good for this document to go out and have clarification.
Yeah.
That people know where it changed.
Show that change, Miss.
Yeah, that would be great.
Sure. Thanks.
So I think one of the things I got from your question to email for Trish was what's the rationale for the widths throughout the city? So, I mean, I think, you know, I understand it's six, right? That's for the Grand Connection and so forth.
Yeah, so the Peg Corridor, clearly on Northeast 6, yeah, has the widest areas. Parts of Bellevue Way, where the Grand Connection would be going, as well as 106 that's right there by the Galleria and California Pizza Kitchen have wider streets. So it generally reflects the level of pedestrian activity and kind of a good level of service for pedestrians to have enough space for walking.
And the map is new, but that's the one that Trish directed you to on page 1.
There were also some considerations when we were looking at this, things like ADA access and what you the width that you need to have two wheelchairs to pass and turn, those kinds of things we talked about as well, and how much what width do you need to have a cafe, and those kinds of issues, just to think about, you know, what are we really looking at here. So okay, I think we've already talked about that one.
We've already talked about pedestrian bridges. It is unchanged. It is just moved from one section to another section. The one modest change is that it defined essentially a public process for council approval, and we have identified the development agreement process as the appropriate mechanism for the council to evaluate these bridges. The reason why we've done that is that development agreement process does require notice. It does require a public hearing before the council, and then the council renders a decision on the final design.
Okay, so landscape development is unchanged with the exception of linear buffers. Linear buffers are 20-foot buffers that go around the downtown boundary. And the change that we made is that they are all vegetated, but we had requests to have patios. Some patios, some paving in there for people to use them when they back up to them. So for the ones that are up against the right-of-way, we have right-of-way or public property. We have actually both of them. We have allowed for 25% of those to be used for private recreation space or residential entries. And then for the ones that are on that back up to private property, they can also be used for vehicular entrances, but they also, the paving still needs to be kept to 25%, and the rest of it is actually a vegetated buffer. So you still maintain the buffer, but you have a little bit of space there, the 25%, to be used for a patio, a barbecue, that kind of thing, because we've had requests for that.
Any questions?
Early wins, you guys know about these.
Yep.
Okay, so the downtown land use charts have remained unchanged except for the footnote in 2 in residential chart that allows for 40% of a congregate care senior housing to be dedicated to nursing home and or assisted living. So you can have 20% nursing home, 20% assisted living along with the congregate care senior housing. Mechanical equipment stayed the same. Street trees and landscaping remained unchanged with the exception of tree species substitution in cases where there's a pest infestation or there's some sort of tree disease. Weather protection is embedded in the right-of-way design guidelines and a little sort of sprinkled around elsewhere. And the wayfinding provisions are the same way. They're embedded throughout the code. There's not one single section where they appear. So that's where the early wins are. And I think that's just one slide.
Can I just ask one quick thing? I just want to be the early wins, which we did forever ago. So the unchanged except, is that since we submitted the early wins, or was that part of our change? I just want to be clear on what the timing of this.
The land use charts remain the same.
Yeah.
We have added in the staff draft that you see here today that note too.
So this is a change from our early wind submission over
so
here.
So early wind plus change okay. Now.
Okay.
So the early winds are incorporated into the code in the most logical location. So you won't find them all in one place. But we have tried to describe here where those have changed since you recommended the early winds and they were adopted by council. And those changes have been very modest.
Okay.
Well,
those are early winds from last season.
Yeah,
it's
like over a year plus. So
that was last year.
That's right.
It was a legacy
win. So it does. I hope that this table of contents that we have moving back and forth helps kind of track those changes over time and helps track the decisions that have been made. I wanted just to say that because this code has been in place for 35 years. That it needed some cleanup. And so given the opportunity that the CAC gave us, the council gave us to make changes, it made sense to do the cleanup at the same time, which essentially created this opportunity for us to move things around and make the organization more clear. So hopefully this table of contents provides you with that roadmap. So that gets through the pieces that we wanted to tell you essentially you've talked about, and there's probably not a lot more discussion, even though we heard loud and clear that you want a parking lot, the parking issue, and the pedestrian bridge issue. So the next piece of the slide is we were going to go on to process provisions, but I did want to make a time check as to whether this would be something that you would like to move on to this evening. It will probably be a longer conversation, a little bit longer conversation, and I do want to make sure that we don't overspend our time that we have here in light of the other issues.
So we still have another 40 minutes or so.
On this issue.
On this
great.
Topic, yeah.
Okay.
Just want to get done early.
Just a time check is always warranted. And is everybody good to go on to the next? Okay. So the process changes start on page... Seven of your packet materials, thank you. At the bottom in 20.25A.030, that starts a new section to this code, but
but it doesn't mean that everything that is in here is brand new. So, for instance, the applicable review section describes that you are required to do design review and you're required to do master development plans. Those two provisions lived in the code previously.
To page 7, right?
And then moved on to 8.
Yes.
But they've been at the very bottom. Okay, very good.
Then on the following pages, we describe, as the process narrows, first that first section describes the entire process. The second section describes the master development plan requirements. And the third section describes what you have to do in design review. Those provisions track very closely the descriptions that are created in BellRed. It actually tracks what is being done now with master development plans. It just brings this code up to the same standard as the other more modern pieces of our code and makes it consistent. So there's really not there's not anything new that's modeled after BellRed. The big piece in this section, and I would just like to note, it has been a piece that we have received feedback on from the BDA and many members of the BDA, is the departure process. One of the pieces of the CAC work that was very important was their idea that there was flexibility in the code, and that flexibility had to create an outcome of livability, but that if our codes were too rigid, that it made it difficult for development to occur, and then hence the livability to occur at the same time. So these departures were created to have kind of two tiers of departures. The first were administrative departures that would be conducted as part of the design review. It's the same; it's part and parcel of the process, but we would document those departures as we went through the permit review. Those would be also subject to public review. Anyone who was requesting one would have to document that they were requesting that departure at the time they filed their application, and the public would be able to comment that on that. So the types of things that that are included in departures are listed essentially throughout the code, but I'm trying to think of some examples for that right now. There are many places in the code that say you can change this by administrative departure, like step backs can be changed through administrative departure process. They can't be eliminated completely, but they can be reduced under certain design criteria. And Commissioner Carlson, I'd like to reference on page 10 some of the decision criteria that you were requesting be present before any departures be considered, and those are in about the middle of the page where we talk about the resulting design being consistent with the comprehensive plan goals, that it's more consistent with the purpose and intent of the code, and that the modification is the minimum necessary to achieve the comprehensive plan objective or the code intent. It's not inconsistent with specific terms of the code, and it may be necessary to ensure consistency with a development agreement that's been adopted by the City Council. That's relatively routine decision criteria you find in a permit, where they have to show that the departure is still supported by the provisions of the code and that it results in a better outcome. Does that make sense? So then we did actually note the kinds of things that there was a limitation on authority. So through the administrative process, where the land use staff would review these proposals and then render a final decision, the limitation on authority at the bottom of the page specifically notes that the land use staff, and that would be me by extension when I sign these staff reports, would not have the flexibility to administratively amend maximum floor plates, intrusions above the sidewalk, minimum setbacks and step backs, maximum building heights, lot coverage, and maximum floor areas. So maximum floor area ratios. So the reason for that is we heard the Planning Commission say that they wanted to ensure that the public understood where we had the authority to depart from the provisions of the code and where there was a limitation on our authority to do so. So it was transparent. Any questions? The legislative departures are the process that the city council would use to approve a development agreement, for instance. Those are for the big departures that might be uncontemplated in the code. One of the things that we have in our in the draft is an amenity that is referred to as a flexible amenity, and that's kind of the build your own program and essentially provide community benefits that then in return you're able to go from your minimum FAR to your maximum FAR. And those would be essentially negotiated as part of this legislative process that ultimately the council would approve. Does that make sense? So those are kind of for the bigger things. As you note here, that it applies to one of the things that we wanted to allow modifications for was the repurposing of buildings. So if there's areas and buildings that already exist, but the uses have become antiquated, and those and we're trying to repurpose those buildings, similar to what we allowed in Bell Red, that those buildings can be essentially put to a new purpose. Through a development agreement, they may be able to have a use that wasn't contemplated for that space. Essentially, so the building doesn't have to be reconstructed. And then the amenities, the kind of the flexible amenity that I described to you previously. Again, there are limitations on the modifications that can be made in this section. I also wanted to note that through this legislative departure process, this has also been described as the mechanism for the council to approve design on certain types of public features. That includes the pedestrian bridges, pedestrian corridor design, and major public open space. Right now, our design guidelines essentially describe a council process, but they don't actually provide any framework for that process. So that this is essentially filling that gap that there's not currently any framework described.
Is the city satisfied with the current design of pedestrian bridges?
So every pedestrian bridge is identified at the location, and then the applicant actually proposes the design. That design is approved by the city council. Part of the reason that it goes through that process is it is over public right-of-way, and essentially a long-term lease agreement has to be entered into for the use of that bridge over time. And so because it is essentially taking up the public realm, the design is ultimately approved by the council, but it is proposed by the applicant.
Would you like to supplement that process at all or change it in any way?
The process right now already is described in the land use code in section 090 of the overlay, and we've retained that. And we did quite a bit of robust work before we adopted those provisions. Emil worked on that, where we did some view angles of the corridors of those roads where we could expect a pedestrian bridge to go, so we're satisfied about their location and the impacts that they may have. And then with the applicant having to come in and propose the actual design of the bridge so that it can be reviewed against the criteria that's in the land use code, I think it is a good process, and then ultimately the council decides and enters into the agreement.
Thank
you. So when it says for the legislative departures, and it says city councilman, is that, can planning commission potentially be part of that? Is that where they may send it to us for review? They ultimately make the decision. But are we part of that process potentially?
So,
or is it 100% on the dais, just council?
It is what the process that is envisioned would, or as the process as it exists and as we've done it now, is that an applicant, for instance, for a pedestrian bridge, applies for that pedestrian bridge through development services. We do all the analysis with respect to consistency with the comprehensive plan, consistency with the guide design guidelines that are in the land use code, and then we make a recommendation to the city council. Because it requires a development agreement, they hold a public hearing, and it receives public notice, and they receive the feedback, and then they approve the final design.
Okay, so council holds the public hearing versus asking the commission to hold the public hearing, which happens.
And the reason that we do that is Bellevue's Planning Commission does not work on project-specific projects. Bellevue's Planning Commission works on the comprehensive plan. They work on creating the code. The departments administer the code, and in some cases, the council is required to approve it because, for instance, in this case, in pedestrian bridges, it spans public right-of-way, and that requires council approval and a lease.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. That's just a piece of information. So there, an applicant wouldn't be required to put in a bridge.
No.
So if a bridge that is slated doesn't get built, does it get moved somewhere else? Does it open up the opportunity for it to go walk away so that the number, I don't know if you know the answer to that. I don't know that everybody would necessarily see the benefit of having a bridge where someone else may really like the opportunity to put in a bridge.
Okay. So as Emil noted before, when we did the original downtown livability work and the transportation back in the mid-2000s, there were auto-oriented streets that were identified, which included Northeast 8th, Northeast 4th, Bellevue Way, which, as all of us have experienced, you stand at the street light, it takes quite a long time to pass the street light, and pedestrian circulation across those streets was very difficult. So pedestrian bridges were identified as a mechanism to add to pedestrian connectivity in those very auto-biased locations. In other areas, we really, as the comprehensive plan envisions now, want pedestrians on the street level. So pedestrian bridges, where they're identified, are in places where second-story retail is permitted. So that actually provides a continuous connection between second-story retail, and it also allows for crossing that auto-biased street. In the code, it's to your question of can they move, it's not specified at an exact location.
It's within
generally a super block. So it identifies a location, for instance, the ones on Bellevue Way, there is allowed one bridge between Northeast 8th and Northeast 6th, and one bridge between Northeast 6th and Northeast 4th. And then there are locations identified on 4th and 8th as well, kind of in that range so that they can be adjusted to accommodate to both.
Thank you.
So that is kind of the survey of the process departures. That is actually what we wanted to get through this evening, having you move through. What I've heard is, so far, I know that the Planning Commission has had a predilection for moving the pieces forward to public hearing so that we can get good public feedback. As I indicated, we have had some public feedback already to that the flexibility requirements here might not fully allow for the type of development that was contemplated by the CAC when they considered super bonuses. And so probably the best place for us to have a conversation about whether we've calibrated the legislative departure correctly is when we talk about the amenities and we talk about how those amenities will reflect kind of height and bulk, and then we can essentially make sure that this is calibrated accurately to allow people to lift to do something that might get the city things like a fire station or a large iconic public building or contribution to something on our CIP. I think one of the examples that has been given to us was something like the Amazon development that's occurring in downtown. That is probably not something that's adequately described or contemplated by our code. But the hope was that this flexible amenity could be used to essentially capture something that's going to be kind of an iconic contribution to the livability of downtown, and that ultimately that would be required to have approval from the City Council to move forward. So we'll have more conversation about the scope of that legislative departure, I think, later when we talk about the substantive provisions. I think that actually summarizes our procedural provisions. So what that leaves us with are the areas of the code that we really want the Planning Commission to focus their review. These are the areas that related to the CIC recommendations and then the direction that you've given us previously, and will probably be the focus of your review over the next month and a half or so. So the dimensional charts, and as Commissioner Hillhorst noted, Trish did create a comparison to help you wade through those complex pieces. The green and sustainability factor was an area where that was an addition to the code and a substantive change. The design guidelines are all new. We'll want to work our way through those. And then the FAR and amenity incentive system is new. We'll probably look at that last and link it up with the information that that Emil and others will be presenting with respect to the BERC work that will be coming back. That's the date. 25th. So I just wanted to note also, we have been responding to comments, or actually, I think you heard some descriptions from some of the folks that spoke this evening that they've submitted letters. The approach that staff has been taking with response to comments is that we are batching those comments in common themes to help you have conversations about them on the nights that we talk about those topics. We are not planning on doing potentially a line-by-line review of comments, but kind of taking that thematic approach to keep us moving through the process up to the public hearing, and then probably following the public hearing, obviously, we'll have some additional discussion. It probably does bear mentioning that we have had some concerns raised in some areas that we will likely be recommending changes to you before the staff draft goes to public hearing. And we have had the benefit of having a couple of developers bring forward projects for us to kind of test against the code. And it's actually identified some kind of friction points. One of those was tower separation. We do know we need to do some work on that. We've created a bit of a complexity that is harder to apply on small sites. And so we do need to do some clarifying language there. There is some concern about the way we've drafted the perimeter step back provisions, so we'll likely bring back some alternative language that addresses folks' concerns there. And I think I've talked to you about the other provisions we'll ask for changes about. We have had heard concerns about the parking issue that you raised, Commissioner Carlson, so, you know, as we go forward, I suspect we'll hear more if that's one that that ultimately gets removed from the package and we retain the status quo until we can do further study. That might be the expedient approach. So if you don't have any, or if you have any other questions of us, we can answer. If not, we can.
I think we just keep moving on there. Yes, get your question.
Are we going to stay on downtown with Emily, or?
No, we're the next step. Okay. I kind of walked through. Emil had talked about the next steps and what you can expect over the course of this month. I would like to say I commend you. You kept moving through that topic. I would like to ask for feedback if there's changes. You know, we are in this process of trying to hear back from you if we're adapting to the way that information is put out to you and how you receive information, if this was kind of a helpful approach.
Certainly. I mean, if I could, was it a question? Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay, so I do have some questions. Some of them are before we started, and this is going back to historical. It's something I don't recall seeing before. It's all the way back to page 3, and it's 2A, the very last phrase. It says long-term, so it's in the downtown office district 1. It says long-term parking and other automobile-oriented uses are discouraged. And so I haven't read that before, and it struck me in terms of automobile uses being discouraged. And then I went to the map, and it's in the sweet spot of downtown, and there's roads that go. So how do you envision that would work? I mean, are you going to barricade it off and have people drive around it? So there's obviously an intent there, and we're not going to let cars be down there. So can you maybe expand a little bit on what that does mean?
I can expand. This was This section was actually living in a different part of the land use code. So there's a, is it
2010.
In the land use code. So we had, because people weren't finding it in the code, we essentially moved it over to the in the downtown section so people could see it. And we did do some minor modifications to some of the definitions here that you'll see on the bottom of page 3 and on to page 4. I don't remember specifically adding in that language, but we will definitely double check to see how specifically this language was modified by staff. Okay. I do my read
you
of
can,
that.
You can see my concern. Yeah.
So my
if
my
we have cars everywhere and not there. How do they get around it?
Yeah. So I think the original intent, as it was written first adopted, was that in the core area, it's basically talking about long-term parking, which means commuter parking, typically.
Which is something entirely different.
Yeah. Right. So to discourage the use of a lot of commuter parking. And also, the original definition of the auto-oriented uses were things like drive-throughs and other things that
right.
had a lot of queuing up in it. In the
right. That goes back to the 80s.
Yeah. So I think this is old language. We have to look exactly how this was modified because I think that is important. And then if we want to...
some clarifying words.
Yeah.
Because this
want to modify
very
it,
different than the discussions
yeah.
that we had, which
right.
I absolutely recollect.
Right. So now if we want to... If we do want to modify it, now is the time to modify this.
Because if I see long-term parking, I remember the commuter discussion, but I'm thinking, well, the hotel might want long-term parking. Or their guests, and is that not allowed, right? So the way it's worded, it can really be interpreted as something very different than the discussions that we had.
And Mr. Chairman, I recall us adding language saying that we encourage all forms of transportation, bicycle, walking, automobiles, multimodal, trucks, and not discourage any form. So, I mean, I thought that was our guiding principle.
Indeed, that was correct, Mr. Commissioner Carlson. So I think it's good to call this out. Thank you, Commissioner Walter. So let's please look at review and make sure we have the right language there.
We will do that. And that language historically has a pretty much one-to-one alignment with language that's included in the comprehensive plan. So we'll make sure that we faithfully translate that.
And again, just to echo to that comment, I think when we had that Vision Zero discussion, likewise, we had said we would not want to deprioritize any particular mode. We'll make sure that we're meeting the needs of all of the citizens across the variety of people. So it's a very good point you raised there, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Another question. On page 38, so I know we didn't talk about amenities tonight, I know we're going to talk about them later, but the table was in the book, I went through the whole book. Parking in the original, there were 23 amenities, and now the list has 18, and parking is no longer there, and I heard that it's moving to a separate study. I'm just curious in terms of the holistic approach to this, since parking sort of is the fabric of everything, kind of, you know, figuratively and literally is underneath everything. Why would it not be part of the overall amenity discussion? And whose call was that to move it to a separate study?
So on this goes back to the CAC process as well as discussions that we had with the commission on June the 8th, 2016, as well as with council on June 20th, 2016. So in those meetings, we had a proposed approach for updating the incentive zoning system, and one of the facets of it was to explore the implications of potentially not giving a density bonus for two key items. One was structured parking or underground parking. The other one was residential use, and there were some rationale that the CAC had discussed and that we had relayed to the commission and council. So the you're correct that it's not in this current list. It's parking still has parking standards and minimum and maximum requirements, as you know. But the BRRC report that we emailed out to you, as well as those that June proposed approach for updating the system, go into quite a bit of detail about the rationale for it. there will, the economic analysis basically looks at the financial implications for a development project or a whole range of development projects for not getting the bonus for it. So it's essentially an up in a raising of the basic or as of right FAR. So a lot of details that we can is going to be discussed by the ULI group as well as this body starting on the 25th. So you're correct that it's not on this list, but it was part of the proposed approach that we talked about back in June.
So I would recommend we also put this in the parking lot as one of the items to come back and make sure we have closure, given some of the variability as well, please. Thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions? All right. If not, I do want to thank you for taking the feedback in, being very flexible about coming back with the approach. Really appreciate the time and the effort, so thanks again. Thank you, so we'll close it out very soon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I don't know if you're still on for the next talk. Take a quick bio break with me. 3 minutes. Yeah.
Copy. Bio break with me.
I know.
Thank you.
Hey, you in trouble?
No.
Why would you been up here?
It's got to
If you go to Bellevue, I've never watched planning commission meetings.
They don't have planning commission meetings on Bellevue.
Oh, they don't? The okay.
That was one of those things we've tried to get some funding to do that. There's just not the video. Do you remember when I asked you about perking and it being off the inside of
We also have our own team. all these meetings.
You're an interesting guy. I find it interesting. I get paid. Sometimes there's some work like that. A lot of times you can find like supporting information,
Let me show you how that went. It was nighttime, right?
To be here.
And he was facing the other way with his son, right? And I came up and I tapped him on the shoulder. He was like, you know, like, hold on, don't rock. Like, yeah. I totally get it, though. I mean, somebody in the dark comes up. And it was a totally different area. I mean, it's nowhere near Bellevue, so it's completely out of context. It was good. Did you enjoy the stand-up?
Yeah, I did.
Of course. I mean, but that's his deal. Okay, so he was
raised in
Will they take it over? The downtown livability, and it's a break time. So, yeah, because we've been going almost for 2 straight hours.
Right.
And you notice the end time.
So, that's why I came back for this.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
So, yeah, they're downtown. Great. Yeah. But, yeah, this is going to be a long session.
Oh, really?
That's why I left. Sorry, I can only take so much.
No fair.
So is downtown livability done?
No, to be continued on the next. It'll continue for several months. Hey, but tomorrow I get special events committee, then I have the arts commission at 4:30, and then I have the transportation commission at 6:30. So
I'll see you at transportation.
Okay, do you realize it's not here?
Southfield Community Center.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure you're going to show up at the right place. So, hi. Chat with you for like 2 minutes right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I was, you know, I was coming in every other day, like, you know, just to decide everything, and I was running one day.
Yes.
Stephanie's in the hall out here.
We are hoping to actually.
Oops.
No, that's 600 feet. Although the flexible community that is,
I heard
charges.
Slide.
We're going to get back.
That's a good question.
Okay.
All right. Hello, Jeremy.
Thanks. Okay, Chair, we're live.
All right. We are back to the business step. Moving on, our next item on the agenda is the single family room rent enforcement. Mr. Collins, so I believe we have Ms. Helen back again. Is that right?
Yes, we do. And we have Mr. Tom Campbell. Thank you, Chair Davidas. The single family room rental enforcement is an information update that is going to be provided by Development Services. This was at the request of the Planning Commission. I think originally, I believe there was a status report given in May 9th, if I recall correctly. And that you had asked for another one. Approximately 6 months later, but because of some constraints with the agenda and the retreat and so on and so forth, and eventually got deferred to January, tonight's January. No action is required. This item is for your information.
Great.
Hi.
Yes, I'm back. So we would like to speak with you this evening about the implementation of Ordinance Number 6223. I'm joined here this evening by Tom Campbell. He is the Code Compliance Supervisor for the Development Services Department. permit. And he has been very involved in the implementation of this ordinance over time. So tonight, Tom's going to manage most of the PowerPoint materials. We're just going to go through a brief summary of the legislative history, kind of some of the outlining provisions that were provided in the rental ordinance. We have some enforcement data, about 18 months of enforcement data to share with you. We do want to also talk just through some of the factors that we've identified that can compromise our enforcement or make it more difficult, and some of the things that we've done to adapt to that and improve our enforcement outcomes. And then we'll just have some conclusions and next steps for you. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Tom.
Ed, thank you for your flexibility and patience in getting to the state in front of you. I think you have a longer report about what we saw late last year. And this is this commission having a little bit of updating. As you know, these were initially adopted as interim regulations pending the Planning Commission's work to develop a permanent ordinance. Permanent ordinance 6222 was adopted in April 2015. It addressed concerns of multiple room rentals, occupancy by unrelated individuals under multiple leases, rooming houses, impacts to neighborhood character, and external impacts of increased density, parking demand, trash, and noise. The provisions in the permanent ordinance, it permits rooming houses only in specific land use districts, prohibited generally in single-family districts. It adds requirements and limitations, specifically about number of rooms that can be rented, parking, maintenance, registration, some other requirements for rooming houses in the zones where those are allowed. It defines other transient lodging uses, such as bed and breakfast and boarding house, and it defines family. This is not more than four unrelated adult persons, unless they're functionally related or functionally equivalent. The enforcement data, you have a table in the report that was submitted separately.
And that actually, just so Tom, that actually starts on page 111 of your
package. Okay. And this was a survey of cases between the effective date of the ordinance, April 14, 2015, through 18 months later, October 14, 2016. 100 complaints, they're broken down and shown on the slide. 50 showed no violation, and we'll get into what that means in a little bit. 25 showed voluntarily complied with code requirements. That's 23.1%. 5, the complaint was withdrawn, 4.6%. 28 were still open as of October 14, 2016. Obviously, numbers have changed a bit since then. We have our first hearing testing the ordinance and the hearing examiner coming up tomorrow, actually, on the new case. So we sent the notice of certified motion, and I believe that was provided to you in the materials as well. Just one quick remark about the no violation. It may mean a finding of no violation, may mean there's no violation. I need to investigate. It may also be that we observe a house, talk with people, and simply are not able to find evidence, although there have been suggestions initially. So, just in terms of the violation, please.
Okay, that's a question.
So, yes.
So, in terms of the complying voluntarily,
yes.
How much time do you give them to ensure those compliance?
That varies. The ordinance does not provide for a maximum time frame. When we initially started out uncertain of how best to most effectively get the information we need to show whether or not there was a violation, it would take longer. Now we're moving pretty much within a 3 to 6 month period. We're trying to move forward the cases that have come up because we're really trying to focus on getting the information, and then if we can't get the information, making a determination to move forward with that.
I'd like to note that sometimes justice moves slowly. The enforcement provisions or process that are contained in our general section of our Bellevue City Code under 1.18, it actually prescribes the steps that we need to take to undertake an enforcement action. And the reason those are there is, at the end of the day, individuals can be charged with a misdemeanor for violating the land use code. They can also be fined, and that fine escalates over time. It starts at $100 a day, and it can increase up to $500 a day. So because we are actually working with people, they can result in a change in their position with respect to their private property, there are essentially safeguards put in place to that require us to move very deliberately, provide significant notice, and try to engage to correct the violation before we take the next steps where a hearing and a big 10 might be a potential outcome.
And just by way of example, for the case going to hearing tomorrow, that started in late August. So it's a little more than 5 months to actually hear the papers. This is a map of the data. We also have versions that might be easier to study on walls and on easel. The comment here, I think the legend, the map legend speaks for itself. You do see concentration geographically in the Lake Hills and Northeast Bellevue area that reflects, I think, in part the age of the housing stock and investments that people make there in renovating house or trying to make it fit rentals, much less in West Bellevue. Some scattered south of I-90 through Newport Hills, Somerset, Lakeville, but not with the concentration you see in the hills.
What's contributing to that concentration?
I think, as Tom noted, it's actually the age of the housing stock, the size of the housing stock, and actually some of the sales, the sale prices and valuation. These houses in Stephanie actually lives in a beautiful neighborhood near a park. The houses are smaller than what we're seeing in our new development. They're actually quite desirable for a couple of populations. One is aging individuals who like those single-story ramblers. They're actually quite accessible in many cases. They're also a good entry market home for young families, but they also are a home that has been identified as desirable for investors because they rent at a good kind of price point for people. So we do see rentals in those areas, which is essentially just because of the housing.
Sorry,
I
noticed that there were circles and diamonds, but it didn't seem that there was a difference in the description. Is there any difference between circles and diamonds in the legend? Or is that how it was in the legend?
Yeah, that was the
circles are single complaint and triangles are multiple complaints.
I believe they're multiple complainants. Isn't that true, as opposed to multiple complaints?
Correct, yeah. The same case, different people are making complaints. So multiple complainants are affecting them at the same time period, not 2 years or so.
From our perspective, if we are getting, co-compliance cases are, we pursue co-compliance cases for the majority of land use issues on a complaint basis. So our life safety and our environmental compliance issues are proactive, as identified by council. The other things like abandoned vehicles, litter, nuisance, single-family rental housing, things like that, those are on a complaint basis. And the reason is that the rationale is that the community will create kind of the standards by which the broader community in that neighborhood really should be adhered. So, in some neighborhoods, the tolerance for deviation from the code is quite small. In other neighborhoods, it's quite large. So it actually does allow some self-determination in neighborhoods. But we are trying to prioritize the cases where we receive multiple calls, because that's an indicator to us that neighborhood is really finding
issue objection.
Yeah, I'm moving on briefly to some of the factors affecting enforcement. We rely on the cooperation of owners and tenants. We initially tried very strongly to have a collaborative and educational approach. There are some challenges with cultural diversity, linguistic challenges, some limits on interpreter resources, but the city is getting much better with that. Then there's the question of some technical terminology, trying to translate the legal language of ordinance or code language into understandable Chinese, Vietnamese, Spanish. So there are also legal limits in terms of privacy and other issues that I think you can imagine. Investigative limits in terms of staffing, when staff is available. Frequently, the external impacts are occurring in the evenings, for example, if you come home from work, that's when you tend to get cars in the cars parked or early in the morning. So we do some investigation outside of business hours, ongoing legal. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask if you see any let's just look at my Airbnb and VRBO.
Yes, we do. And actually, that is one of the things that we included in your packet materials later. An interpretation that we did that started on page 115. And because of these investigative limits, we have a limited opportunity to knock on someone's door for a code compliance issue that is not an imminent threat and say, we have to ask permission for access into that place. So we are quite limited in what we can do to ascertain the number of people that are living in a home. So we watch cars, we kind of do a mini observation at certain times of day. We do have staff coming in before hours and after hours on certain time frames and looking at cars. But for instance, we can't, for the purposes of identifying who's living in a home, run someone's license plates. That's not considered an allowed code compliance function. Our police officers can do that for traffic violations and for other criminal violations, but we can't do that for the purposes of identifying where people live. There are just certain privacy issues that are in tension with our ability to influence this code. So what we have seen is that, as you indicated, we're seeing postings on VRBO, Airbnb, and what we did was we adopted this code interpretation that dealt with that, said things that are within the framework of the code that you recommended and the council adopted last year, that those types of transient uses are not permitted in single-family neighborhoods. And by doing this code interpretation, then we're able to hold that up as a piece of evidence to people in the hearing that's actually going tomorrow. Is an instance where were operating VRBO. We were able to collect information off the website about the rental. We were able to observe the effects of that rental on the neighborhood, and we were able to ascertain who the responsible parties were and get them to hearing tomorrow. Because we have this code interpretation that says VRBOs are not allowed, we have very strong legal authority that for our hearing examiner to apply to this case. And our hope is, in a perfect world, that we would, at the end of the day, get a voluntary agreement, where we would get a correction of their violation through an agreement that we would then be able to enforce in the future as a contract. And that gives us far more latitude. So those are the kinds of things that we're trying to put in place as to make the application and the enforcement of this code more efficient.
Just to get a final clarification, so the VRBO, not okay. So if this is the case of the hearing tomorrow, there's not going to be a contract of an exception allowing it, correct? It's just you can't run VRBO, not permitted.
In single family neighborhoods. What we concluded is that what the interpretation concluded is that kind of VRBO, Airbnb, or transient rentals that under the terms of our code are defined as a rooming house. Mm-hmm. And rooming houses are not permitted in single family.
Okay, so this person has to not run that business anymore. Okay, thank you.
Oh, they could, we do have a provision for transient rentals for bed and breakfast.
Uh-huh.
But remember, in those circumstances, bed and breakfast were required to be home or occupied.
Yeah.
And the structure that we had, it was not owner occupied, it was just being serially rented. And, you know, they would come in and clean in between renters, and, you know, typically that you arrange just like Airbnb, that's not going to be. But there is a permit process that allows people to have bed and breakfasts in single-family neighborhoods, but they are limited to two rooms. They are limited to a maximum of three guests.
Right,
time.
Two rooms. So they, you could have married couples as single person.
They have to be owner occupied and they have to provide off street. So that actually goes through the permit process to be owned.
And do they also need a business license to run a business in the city of Elmwood?
A B&B would, yes. Okay. Actually, VRBO would too. They just aren't allowed to do it anymore. They just aren't allowed to do that same kind of thing.
Right. Okay.
So, we have a case that was successfully approved just this week where out-of-country owners, their adult daughter lived in the house when she was not an owner. They had two units downstairs. They were given their Airbnb. The owner was very cooperative, but they did most of the stuff in the business from China. And stopped the Airbnb listing. Got a registration for an accessory dwelling. Put his adult daughter on the title to that, so it is under occupied. And now he's moving forward with the building that they have. As an accessory dwelling unit, or with a mother.
As an apartment.
Lease period, not an accessory.
Mother-in-law.
Yeah. Okay.
So that was brought into compliance.
So, at the risk of getting into a side discussion, we used the phrases VRBO, Airbnbs on the same category, just to clarify. So we are talking about just individual rooms within a single family home. Is there any restriction around renting the entire home?
You can rent the entire home to relate to a family, and there's no regulation attached.
Even for short-term rentals?
No, you cannot do that. You can't do transient rentals. It has to be, you have to fit into that category of renting the whole house and you have to have a lease for a longer period of time. And you either have to be unrelated, or you have to be related, or you have to be four or less.
And I think of VRBO as the whole house. Typically it's the whole house. Airbnb, I feel like that's more the group.
Yes.
Like, to me,
usually.
Yeah. To me, that seems my difference in my head between the two.
Right, but there's overlapping between both. Like the case tomorrow was the whole house advertised on Airbnb. Yeah. We're trying to take them up to 11:43.
Oh, my God. Okay.
So actually, the other thing while we're just talking about that is, you know, we don't have mechanisms in our code. This home is actually the home that we'll be going to here in town. The top one that's identified with two front doors. We do not have regulations in our code that say you can only have one front door on your house. Now, who would have thought people would put two front doors on their houses? But when we adopted that definition, we said it's but one kitchen. It's unless you're in a accessory dwelling unit, it has some other characteristics, but it doesn't say anything about not having two front doors.
So this
is one house, and they have, sadly, in Stephanie's neighborhood, this has happened a couple of times, where people have come in and done changes to the inside of the house that are not inconsistent with the building code. They may have done structural things that comply with the building code, but clearly that leaves the impression that that is not. So one of the things, you know, that we have identified as a gap that probably needs to be filled in our land use code is defining some of the characteristics of a single family home that make it a single family home. So that we eliminate kind of the impact, the aesthetic impact that gets attached when people do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, including the ordinance expanded our regulatory authority over single-family rentals, reduced the number of overcrowded rental houses and their external impacts. We received one email this evening from a neighbor across the street from a house that we Commissioner Walters knows about, saying, expressing appreciation for the reduction in impacts and activity around that house.
I think it was one that you referred to is we, our efforts to work them towards voluntary compliance, we did not evict them, but the pressure that we placed on them to comply with the code resulted in people to move on.
So, we very appreciate who lets me know that you know who you used to be.
Yes.
No, it's going to work.
Well, and you know, we have some, the co-compliance officers are working with the
We're trying to continue to learn from our experiences and also learning from the experiences of other jurisdictions, including in-state jurisdictions like Seattle, like Fulmer, other comparable jurisdictions around the country. A lot of university fields try to deal with the issue of student houses and try various approaches. And so we're going to continue to look for ways to improve education, effectiveness, information on code enforcement cases generally, including single-family rental cases, is now available through mybuildingpermit.com.
Right. Actually, there was, this was one of the questions that you asked last time we were here in May of last year, that you couldn't find information as part of our big data initiative about enforcement cases. And so we put our heads together after that meeting, and we had not previously posted code enforcement cases on our mybuildingpermit.com portal. And the reason is because there is an exception from the Public Records Act that allows people to be anonymous, to be request to be, their names to be redacted from code enforcement cases, so they don't suffer from some forms of retaliation. And the way our systems had been created is that information was available in our system, and if someone came in and requested the records, we would have redacted it, with a pen. But our system didn't have a way to redact it. So we did work with our technology folks, and we created different fields that the information with respect to the complainant is in a field that's not visible to the public. And so that information is now posted. We couldn't go backwards and undo all the files because they weren't, the information wasn't contained in a common location in our database. But moving forward from, I think it was mid-December, now the data will all be posted on the website. So
nice. And one addition, and so by address and by file number and by addition, by searchable. Our city website, the public website, is undergoing a major revamp, and one of the things we'll be able to do there is be able to post updated data tables, graphs, and maps like this one. And for certain code types where people or the commission are interested, we'll be able to update that in maybe a quarter. That will be happening later this year.
Thank you.
So that's all we have. Just an update, but if you have questions, we're happy to answer.
Really appreciate the update. Thank you for the discussion as well. Any questions across the board?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. No, I just, thank you for the listing, for the map, for giving us the history. We've made progress in a year, so I think that's great. And it'll be interesting to see how the first hearing goes. It's just great. So thank you for following up on it, because, I look at that double house thing and it just kind of, if they're not permitting these changes, that is just a potential tragedy waiting to happen if a fire breaks out and there's not, there's bad wiring in a house or not fire alarms and stuff like that. And so, it's just our people that are just trying to have a affordable lifestyle, I think, are in danger with this stuff. So hopefully we're potentially keeping tragedy from happening by going through this.
We aggressively pursue the building violations, we do that proactively. These double doors, though, those could have been approved through the building code.
Sure.
Because there isn't anything in line, just go to the building code that says we can only have one door. So, interestingly enough, when you look at our accessory dwelling unit provisions, it says you can only have one front door, and that the door to the accessory dwelling unit must be on a different front face of the house. So we're just seeing the need to transport that provision into our single family provisions, just so we don't end up with things that don't match the character. I think, too, just to note, you know, Betsy Hummer made part of her comments today had some conclusions about adult family homes. And I don't know if you remember, if all of you were part of that conversation, but the city can't directly regulate adult family homes. Those are, we've been preempted. We actually were involved in some significant federal litigation over this topic where we were on the losing end and accused of discriminating against people, persons with disabilities. And it created some of the case law that's applicable to all jurisdictions now that you cannot treat adult family homes differently. That said, there are some things that every home should have to provide that actually reduces the number of impacts that neighbors see. Like, we should never have a situation where garages are not built with new homes, so it physically doesn't leave a place to park your cars. I mean, we do all know that a lot of us keep junk in our garages, but if you don't have any garage whatsoever, it forces your car onto the driveway, and then there is actually no option for these cars whatsoever. So, you know, we have had instances where that's happened to maximize the internal floor area of a home. They excise out the garage, but that pushes their impacts onto the street. That's probably a gap we need to fill in our land use code. The two doors is probably a gap we need to fill in our land use code. And provided that we regulate single-family homes across the board, whether they're single-family or a traditional family, a functional equivalent of a family, or an adult family home, provided we stipulate the things that make our community viable and livable, those apply across the board. We just have to treat them as. So I think that there are some things that we can do that will, regardless of who the developer is and for what purpose, ensure that the character is consistent across the board. And so we'll be, as we think about our work program moving forward with the City Council in 2017, we'll probably be using some of those changes.
Can I add a comment? Just around the corner from me, there was a house for sale, and in the real estate agent's documentation, it said, and this is a single family neighborhood, the house is plumbed or prepared to have two dwellings. So it was red, you know, and so we reported that.
House ready subdivided.
Right, right. And so it's really prevalent, and I think there's a lack of understanding that that's not okay, even to the point where it was a real estate agent that didn't know it wasn't okay to take one house and turn it into two.
We have, we also coordinate with the master builders because there is actually a phenomenon that we're seeing that, especially in some of our larger home communities, that two kitchens are very popular. And the problem is, in that case, is that they can be used to a rental purpose. Not quite as likely, but they can be. But we're looking for the sweet spot in balancing kind of what clients are asking their contractors to build in new homes, oftentimes including two kitchens, but then also essentially trying to foreclose the ability for that to be used as an illegal duplex or something in that regard. So one of the things that we've asked people to do ever since the single-family rental housing work issue came up was that if there are two kitchens, we require them to enter into a single-family use agreement. And again, then we're not investigating, we're enforcing the terms of a contract. We're saying, okay, well, you can have your second kitchen, but be aware that we're going to require you to sign a contract that says you're only going to use it for your family, and you're not going to rent that out. And that makes our enforcement job easier at the end of the day. Because then if we're investigating, we can require entry, we can require them to demonstrate to us that they're complying with the terms.
Yes, the agreement is recorded and runs with the property, so.
So maybe future stuff.
So in that case, this is an in-law suite, that's what you mean. So with that second kitchen, typically it's an in-law suite.
So it's more entertaining. Entertaining in the basement.
More likely it's entertaining because we are getting these three-story homes.
Yeah. I've seen it with in-law suites in different parts of the country.
And those are, under the terms of our code, the terminology is accessory dwelling. And that belongs to each of those.
Thank you very much. I think this is about on time.
Thank you.
So we'll keep moving on. So I believe the next topic is a review of the output from the retreat, Mr. Collins, all right?
Yes.
So we'll give it to you, perhaps, to lead us on.
Sure, yes, Chairman. The next one is a study session. It is the Planning Commission post-retreat review of the revised prototype Part B, the suggested standards and practices piece. This is a follow-up to the retreat as it's held on November the 16th. And to refresh your memory, I, at the request of the chair, prepared and others prepared a prototype that consisted of local governance and planning, a sort of description of how planning and the Planning Commission's function fits into local government. And then a second piece that was suggested somewhat of a best practices for the Planning Commission in terms of operational guidelines. And then the third piece was the guiding principles, which I believe the Planning Commission prepared post 2014 retreat. So there's three parts to it. The part that we're most interested in discussing tonight is Part B. And at the retreat, there were three different groups represented for the Planning Commission. There was a city council liaison, and there was staff. So during the retreat, what we came up with was a facilitated retreat. We discussed all of the different parts of the suggested best practices. And this is a compilation of the thoughts based on the language that I understood that you had approved. There's some minor word twixing to make it work. And so what the process is staff has had a chance to review the output, and I have indicated that I believe if there was a few small places where they had modified the language a bit, and I put those as footnotes. There's one question that is still outstanding that staff had asked me to investigate, and I'm waiting to hear back from our attorney, and that is on part number 11 in that part of the prototype. And for the most part, though, staff had agreed that everything looked like it was reasonably represented for the retreat. So we're going to follow through. The next step is to have the Planning Commission do likewise. We're not asking you to take formal action on it. These are suggested standards of how you operate or how to approach certain situations. And then we'll ask, the final piece of that will be asking the City Council liaison, the mayor, to take a look at it and say, yes, I agree with this. And that once everybody has seen what everybody else thinks needs to be changed with it, then we can all say we've got a prototype that we all three parties agree to. And then we'll move into, there's two other pieces that are going to go with this. The guiding principles, one of the Planning Commissioners asked if we could have a separate discussion on that, which we will do, at a date to be determined. It will be in the next few weeks. And then the other part was perhaps adding your bylaws into the prototype so it becomes more of a comprehensive document from guiding principles to bylaws to best practices. And then the final part is that we put into the parking lot the discussion about public engagement policies, the practices of public engagement.
So that will be a separate discussion to the whole program. And so what I'll do is I'll turn it over to you now. I can walk through all of this if you'd like, or if you have specific questions or concerns, and to see after the discussion is settled where, if you feel that there's a general consensus that we are, that the document reasonably reflects what you had agreed upon at the retreat itself.
First, again, I want to thank you, Mr. Cullen, for the effort, the energy, and to building up the prototype, and the feedback group review discussions. I really want to thank you again for that.
On my part,
it was a non-trivial effort, and I realized that took a lot of time. Secondly, given that we are missing, technically, we are missing two of our commissioners who were not then in the retreat, would it be prudent for us to review this at a time when we do have all of the commissions in attendance? I still think it's not good ahead, so.
Well, I will tell you that the likelihood of having all the commissioners in attendance, reason being is that downtown livability is going to be at the front of every one of your agendas for the foreseeable future. So this will be appearing on your agenda about this time. And I don't have a problem with that, but it's just that some of the commissioners have to leave earlier because they've got early morning work commitments. So we may be in a position where you're not going to have all of the commissioners here to discuss at the same time. Two of them were not at the retreat itself.
Good.
So it's, and one of them, Commissioner Lang, rightfully understood that it's difficult for him to weigh in on it and suggest, you know, what could be or should be, because it is a carefully constructed and facilitated dialogue. And the idea is that you're not going to be making very big changes to this, because that then, that has to then go back through all of the sort of the negotiations as sort of the facilitation, and that would be challenging to do. My biggest concern would be with Commissioner Morisseau, who is she was at the retreat and she weighed in on it. So it's possible you can start the discussion tonight and conclude it at another meeting. There's no sense of urgency in getting through it at tonight's meeting. But I want to be timely about it, because operationalizing some of this is going to take a little bit of time on our side and the staff.
I'm going to make it a little quick, only because we spend however much time tonight and then rehash. So for those folks who anticipate moving early on the day that we do plan to talk about it, maybe they can say, hey, I have comments, and then hopefully the commission will get some discussions since you have been
waiting. So, do we not have the ability to adjust our agenda to put this first at a meeting? I mean, we've changed our agenda multiple times. You've heard me say, I would really like to have had the full complement of commissioners there, and I feel the same about this. I'd be willing to start a meeting a half an hour early if need be, but if we could just flip our agenda one meeting to have this and give it, you know, discrete amount of time, I would like to do that.
I mean, it is your meeting. You have the flexibility to do that. Why I was saying that downtown livability would be on the front of every one of your agendas is because you've got public here. And the way we prioritize items for the agenda are any items, public hearings are first. Any items that are directly related to something the council's requested or involve some sort of work responsibility that's directly, such as a code amendment, those are second, and then informational and all other items fall on a third priority on the agenda. That's how we've been trying to arrange it. You have the flexibility to shift that around, and you can do that. if you do, I strongly encourage that you put a time limit around it so that we don't have the public waiting halfway into the evening before they can be heard or hear what's going on in the downtown.
Just if I may suggest, Mr. Chair, I agree. I think it might be tough to get all seven of us. And so just a suggestion, if we move portions of this forward, that when you put it on the agenda, you reach out to primarily the commissioners that missed the retreat and maybe offer to have a conversation with them, phone or live, and you can maybe do it together, or if you would like one of us to join you, whatever you'd like to do. And that way, give them 30 minutes or an hour of deep, you know, what question, have you read the material? Please read the material for me. Do you have any questions? And then address it. And that way, you can confidently come into the meeting saying, I have their feedback. We don't have to wait for them. Just a suggestion, sir. And then the other thing is, I was wondering if we could possibly prioritize the guiding principles. And I say that because, you know, that's a couple of years overdue. So, you know, that would be just a suggestion. And I think that can be separated potentially from what we do at retreat since this was done earlier. I think a good majority of us were there for this. I know some commissioners wanted to just touch base and say, this is work for today's commission. But just a suggestion, because that's like one slide, one paper, that we could just do an early win, knock out, and have it. So just my suggestions to the chair.
So really, that was very good. So thank you very much. And really, on the second one, I think it makes a lot of sense, perhaps, to, because you're right, it's about 2 years overdue. On the first one, just so people have the visibility, Mr. Coleman, I did have a call with the folks who missed the retreat to the extent we could.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the rest of you don't have the same visibility into the call, and while I could give you a summary, or even give you a summary, it's still me translating your 45-minute phone call, and I'm working my own words, and hence my concern that if they're missing commissioners, perhaps we should defer. With that said, I'm certainly not in favor of prioritizing this upfront in the agenda. I think we should prioritize availability coverage, especially the public input. But my takeaway is perhaps I could reach out to the commissioners and certainly sometime in the next couple of sessions we find one or we at least get 36 commissioners and see if we can close it up. And that said, I like the you can focus on the guidelines. Perhaps that is something we could discuss today, Mr. Powell.
Well, it was actually Commissioner Morisseau that had emphasized a very strong interest in having a separate discussion on the guiding principles. So I would be hesitant to do that.
Well, like I said, Nick, all right.
Sure, but if you know, going forward, I mean, we can talk any portion, yeah. But if it's a meeting where we want just something quick, you can take that out and put it in for this that agenda, and then do the other something. Just a suggestion.
That's
just from
a
time perspective.
So I think basically the consensus is that we will confirm this.
And what I'll do with your permission, I'll put an added emphasis that we really do need to have all the commissioners weigh in on this. And if they can't be here for it, they still need to weigh in. That's really important. And then we'll try to work their questions or comments into the discussion, and maybe we can filter it through and over the course of two meetings, January 25th and February 8th. That's what we're looking for.
Thank you. So with that moving on, I believe that one draft minutes to review.
Yes.
So December 7th.
And I've got several for you to sign.
Thank you.
motion on the December 7th minutes?
Yes.
Thank you for the reminder.
Oh, got you. We stopped. Are we talking about the 7th?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't know if you were done signing. So on page 197, third paragraph down, says, I think it says Eastgate OLB2. I think it should say TUV as well.
Where Tom was focused on EG, OLB2, and TUV.
Yeah. And Aaron channeling another commissioner, Michelle, removing the list. But on page 200, second paragraph,
yeah.
Advice is spelled with a C.
Yes.
My mother, the English teacher.
It's a noun, not a verb.
I don't see many spelling things, but that one I do because I'm not my name. And that's it for changes.
Do we have a motion to approve the minutes? Yes. Second.
Second.
All of you say aye.
Aye.
No, I think that's I think it's almost on time. Actually, I had a time today. Public comment, Ms. Hummer, do you have?
Oh, you are so kind. Good everybody.
It's VIP service.
Texting, I know. I'm so glad I came back. Geez, what a great meeting. And it sounds like we're making progress with the single family rentals. And I really appreciate Carol's.
Sorry, you'll have to come up if you'd like to address.
But she can hear me.
But here.
I'm glad I came back to the meeting. Thanks again for your great public service and your diligence. Thanks for not calling me out for texting during the meeting and stuff. I did pay attention. And I appreciate being heard, and I appreciate Ms. Helen's calling me out on my comments. That was pretty impressive that somebody listened. And I just look forward to us being good public servants. Like I said, I just keep coming back to that. Our constituents are the Bellevue residents, and we owe them, you know, we owe them the respect to do what seems to be the right thing in there for them. They're the ones who vote. They're the ones who vote for us. They're the ones actually who hire us and appoint us, even though it seems like somebody else. And I think sometimes in this technical jargon, we lose sight of that. And they'd already mentioned Bellevue College wants a street for free. I want you guys to know that because I think it sets a real precedent. You know, if we give them a street for free, there are three other streets they're going to want in my neighborhood. And that sounds like $10 million to me. And if we start giving stuff away to Bellevue College, the PSE is going to want free stuff, the State Patrol is going to want free stuff, the school district, and pretty soon we'll just kind of be bankrupt and having all these entities run us. And the Bellevue residents end up shortchanged. So thanks again for your public service and doing such a great job.
Thank you very much.
Do we have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Do we have a second? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much. Have a good evening.
All right.